the power of key points and instructions to refine perception is really amazing when it's just laid out very clearly. This is the time for anything at all that you want to ask.
I've thought of past movements that describe themselves as revolutionary. They seem to have gotten lost in a metaphor of agricultural increase or imperialism leading to almost delusional Stalinism at points about exactly where the movement is going. And, it's always better and better and better and stronger and more overwhelming and self-deception on the part of the participants. So I thought of great freedom as like being a matter of phenomena can't be increased or decreased or improved or worsened, but perhaps it can be, the pressure of phenomena can be kind of diminished, like all across the board, regardless of what ideas are involved, just less pressure on everybody. I don't think it would be like an imperial growth.
Any other questions?
So when all the points of view are resolved and awareness is permanent, and there's the full out shining of all points of view 24/7, there's an individual participating in the world, but the pure awareness is all that remains in that experience, is the essence of each experience. That actual person that has realized the awareness, are they experiencing any sense of differentiation inseparable from awareness? And the related to the naming of things, is that experience? Is there experience without the naming of things, or with the resolution of full breath? It's kind of ridiculous.
Well, no, it really isn't a ridiculous question at all. It's a very good question, because your question has to do with the self or the individual identity and how one comes to identify oneself as an individual and the cognitive process by which one determines that one is an individual, and that somehow that individual is someone to be basically feared in some ways, in that there will always be thoughts and emotions that the individual is having that need to be either accepted or rejected. So it's a very good question, and it certainly ties into other questions asked. Our descriptive frameworks for individual identity are built by our exposure to different ideologies of the self, different ideologies of individual identity, and those ideologies can be scientific, political, theological, or religious, or of another kind. And when we're continuously exposed to these ideologies, then we assume that they have something to do with us. In other words, we hear from experts that we have thoughts that and emotions that need to be accepted and others that need to be rejected. And so we assume that applies to us. We assume that that has something to do with the way we are. And it's just the nature of being human that we're always looking for meaning. We're looking for significance in terms of our own existence. What is the meaning and significance of our own existence, of our own individual identity? And we're always looking for a way to live peacefully with whatever that is. And so, you know, throughout time, different ideologies have gained great momentum, whether they're scientific, political, or theological or religious. They gain great momentum, but they always have a sense of incompleteness because they're usually based on extremes. They're usually based on very extreme ideas that, as I said, are incomplete. They never reach any kind of fruition. They never reach any kind of point at which they give a complete answer to what is seen as the problematic nature of being human. And this drive to accept or reject thoughts and emotions that seems to be pivotal in most ideologies to determining what an individual is. It's really important to understand the very, very great limitation of individual authorship and authority when it comes to determining the nature of the self and what an individual is. Most of the, as you said, Shao, imperialistic notions that come about are the notions of an individual that are then, and they're usually intellectual notions that are then adopted by many, many people. And when it comes to creationism and evolutionism, certainly those notions are based on either faith, or when it comes to theology or religion, or to the scientific method when it comes to scientific and technological processes. So both of those, faith and the scientific method, they're intellectual processes. They require thought as a support to understanding them in relation to the self. So, for example, with faith, it requires the step of a thought that says, well, I feel incomplete in myself. I don't quite know what to make of this whole project of an individual identity, and so I'm going to have faith in a creator, something that I don't really understand, and in that way I'm going to tie my little life raft of the self to the great ship of creationism, where I'm going to say that I have faith in some kind of a creator that I can't understand, who has power over me. And if I just have faith in that creator, then I'm going to feel some kind of completeness in myself. And, you know, if indeed that worked, it might be a solution. However, it doesn't work. And so that's what I mean about it being incomplete. It's incomplete in that it doesn't work for people. It doesn't provide immediate benefit to people in order, in some way that would resolve the whole issue of personal identity. And then when the scientific method is used as a support, we rely on scientific ideas about what's going on with the brain or the body or or whatever it might be, and what experts have determined might be going on with the brain and the body. And those are usually very sterile, in addition to being very incomplete ideas about the actual nature of human experience. So you see, what we're coming down to here is the actual nature of human experience, how human beings actually experience themselves in their own life, in relation to themselves and others and the whole project of living life, rather than the experience of being human as set out by authorities who are usually very, very removed from any of us living life. In other words, they're in the ivory towers of academia, or increasingly within corporations where there are groups of individuals, but very small groups of individuals who are authoring the whole project of personal identity. And so, you know, this is certainly one interesting way of going about living a life, but what about all of us? You know, what about 7 billion people who are just trying to live life on a daily basis and who need some kind of immediately beneficial solution to being comfortable in life? So all of these ideas, they don't offer immediate benefit. They offer some kind of projected long-term benefit, perhaps. Well, if we just have enough faith in something, then that'll carry us through. Or if we can just figure out through the scientific method what's going on with the individual, then maybe sometime way off in the future there'll be something that comes about, some kind of way of re-engineering the biology of a human being or the physiology that can somehow bring a human being to some kind of complete state. However, let's face it, what we all want is benefit right now. We want some kind of immediately beneficial way of being that can apply to us right now, that can resolve our issues of living a human life right now, not some kind of intellectual project of the future, but some kind of direct experience of what it means to be human. And when we look at the most basic elements of what it means to be human, we're usually told that we are a human being and that we have a nature. And when those two are tied together, that's human nature. But there's no nature, human nature, that's separate or apart from all of nature. So what we have is an experience, or what we could say is a cognition of ourselves as being human, and we have a cognition or experience of ourselves as being part of nature. And when we just look at this basic cognition, no matter what kind of label we give it, whether we call it consciousness or awareness, then we can say too that that's something very basic to our experience, to a complete experience of being human. We have to have awareness or consciousness in order to experience being human. And even this is being picked apart ad nauseum today in the scientific community, where experience and consciousness are increasingly being seen as neuroscientific events that don't really have any kind of basis whatsoever in terms of living a human life. But all of this, it's just a constant, frantic need to cling to intellectual experience in order to describe what it means to be human. For me, that's never been enough. I've seen it all and I've read it all in my 60 years. And what I've seen is that there's never been any kind of project undertaken that really deals with human experience. What about the way all 7 billion people, or close to 7 billion people, are actually experiencing themselves on a daily basis? And what can support that experience in a way where people can live a happy life? That's what we really want to know. We want to know how we can be happy within ourselves and then be beneficial in a simple way to others. That's what we really want to know. That's the information that is needed. It's the information that is most necessary. And it's the information that's most vital to living life. Otherwise, we're just a bunch of talking heads talking to each other about our own interpretation of the authoritative statements we've heard pronounced by others. But we don't really need a bunch of authoritative statements or pronouncements. What we need are key points and instructions, pivotal instructions about how to see ourselves and how to be comfortable within ourselves on a daily basis. That's what we need. We need some kind of wisdom that's just going to be supportive of that rather than authoritative statements about the nature of the self and neuroscientific activity or reengineering the biology or physiology in order to somehow make it work. We don't really want any more sterile solutions where we're just a bunch of talking heads talking at each other, but with no real intimacy or connection with ourselves or with others. I think everyone pretty much is fed up with that, even if they don't know it. When we find something about ourselves that is just a simple place of complete rest, where we can rest our cognition or awareness, just as it simply is, it's the forerunner of all mental or emotional activity. There wouldn't be any way to identify mental or emotional activity or any kind of sensory activity altogether without awareness. There has to be awareness of that in order for there to be a description of it. And if we can just rest that consciousness or awareness or cognitive activity in itself for a moment, then we can start to really examine the nature of all this activity and whether or not it really can make or break our day, so to speak. And when we rest as awareness, then we start to see more and more what's really going on. And resting as awareness isn't really an intellectual support. It may seem to be initially, but what it grows to be is direct perception of the nature of our own experience. So we come to have a definitive understanding about our own experience that doesn't need to be mediated or interpreted by any authorities on the topic. So, you know, when we come to a conclusion about our very own experience, then we don't need any authorities on the topic. Whatever authorities on the topic have to say is simply what they have to say. And it may or may not apply to our understanding of ourselves. When we've trained our perception so that we believe that some thoughts are scary and ones that we need to stay away from, or some emotions are frightening and we need to stay away from those, and other thoughts and emotions are beneficial and we somehow need to gather up a whole bunch of those in order to tie down our blimp of self to some kind of grounding in where, you know, we can feel like we have solid ground under our feet, then that becomes the lifetime project. That's what we do from the first breath we take until the last one. And if we don't find something naturally settled within ourselves that is the basis of all of our experience, then we'll constantly be running after some way to describe ourselves as either being hopelessly emotional or intellectual, or maybe we find ourselves to be superior to others. We find that we have some kind of superior emotional or intellectual capacity, and then therefore we know more than others. We know better. We've come to some kind of superior thought structure or emotional structure within ourselves that is better than what's going on with the other riffraff that are part of the human experience. But the thing about finding the naturally settled reality within ourselves is that it is not a project of extremes. So it's not a project of superiority or inferiority. It's a project of equalness. It's the true equal opportunity program, where we come to find the great equalness that exists at the basis of nature itself. And we find that we really are an expression of nature. That's all we are. And what we are is nature. We are first and foremost nature's intelligence. We're not first and foremost an individuated phenomenon. First and foremost, we are nature's intelligence. And when we look at nature's intelligence, if we just sit here for a moment and observe it, we can see that everything is unified and organized within nature in an inexplicable way. And no matter what proliferates or resolves within nature, it remains naturally at ease and naturally settled. And so then we can say, well, you know, this is really what we are. Not only am I looking at something that, in terms of my own individual experience, but I see that this is really the way nature operates. And as nature's intelligence is really all that we are, then that's our basic operating system. That's what our operating system is. This natural ease and completeness, super completeness, that's at the basis of everything. And then if we really get in touch with our own awareness as our connection with that, then more and more we can experience ease through resting this awareness for short moments, repeated many times until it becomes automatic. This is a process that is not intellectual, and it's not even a process. It's just a way of identifying with ourselves as we really are, without any need to think about identifying with anything. It's just that we've overlooked, we haven't noticed our own basis, our own ground, and our own intelligence. We haven't really noticed what that is. So when we notice it for short moments, repeated many times, then we refine our perception, and we have a direct perception of ourselves as we are, rather than a perception that we've trained to make believe that we are a certain way, that we are constantly at war with our thoughts and emotions, and that we're always either inferior or superior to others, and that we're always comparing ourselves with everything in some way, comparing ourselves with others or comparing ourselves with ourselves. The importance of the book, The Solution to All Problems, Nature's Intelligence, is that it isn't really so much about the experience of an individual authority. It's about the experience of everyone. It's a project of everyone really taking a look at what the nature of their own experience is. This is the right of everyone. It's the birthright of everyone. No one can take away that birthright or alter it in any way. So it's up to you, it's up to everyone to determine the nature of their own experience. And if that happens to be opposed to academic authorities or political authorities or theological or religious authorities, then that's just the way it is. By gaining confidence in your own awareness, what you'll see about your own experience more and more is that it is without extremes. It doesn't need any kind of input in terms of descriptive frameworks to make it what it is. It doesn't need any kind of intervention by thought or emotion to verify it. And so when you find that basis within yourself, you see that just like nature, you've always been free of extremes. Nature is completely free of all phenomenal extremes that occur within itself. Nature is, it continues to be, no matter what phenomenal extremes occur. Nature isn't dependent on anything in order to be. And everything that appears within nature is a phenomenon of nature. It isn't something. There's never anything that appears within nature that's over and against nature, or that can pull something over on nature, or can establish itself as being independent of nature. And so just like that, it is true of nature, it's true of human nature as well. There isn't any kind of self-named or other-named phenomena of your own experience that is separate or apart from the very easeful basis of what nature is. And so all of our thoughts and emotions and sensations, no matter what they are inseparable from that complete ease of being that is essential to every single experience we have. And those two are inseparable in the same way that the sky and the color blue are inseparable. They're not really two things. There is no two there. There just seems to be two, or seem to be two, as long as there's some kind of effort to describe them as two. But if there's no effort to describe anything as two, or anything as separate from ease, then there isn't anything separate from that complete ease of being, whether it's something wonderful or something awful. Descriptions are just descriptions. They can't bring anything to bear on the complete ease of nature as it is. It isn't necessary to stop labeling or stop describing. In fact, that would be impossible. At this point, it would be completely impossible. And to do so is only to adopt another extreme. It's only another imperialistic effort to impose some kind of regime on human experience. The labels, no matter what they are just another expression of nature, which is always at ease. They're not anything that is the basis for action. Action that one feels one needs to establish well-being. The well-being of everything is already ensured. Now, you know, I hear all kinds of ways people are trying to modify themselves, whether they're mundane, like eating Twinkies or Hostess cupcakes and watching television, or in other words, you know, many people in the world are just like fast food or sugar or of one form or another, and television just as a way of feeling okay. And that's just one way to go about it. And then there are others that are more outside the mainstream and more rarefied. And so some of those, but all of these require some kind of movement into action. Like, oh, if I just have some sugar, I'll feel better, I'll feel full. Or if I just can watch television, I can get away from the madness in my head. Or if I can just find some Viagra, I'll be able to to experience that release from it all for a moment. Or, you know, so there's this constant move to find something. And then in a more rarefied way, we see, or I certainly see, other ways that people are either subtly or overtly trying to modify their experience in order to get it into some kind of state of well-being. And a couple of the popular ones today are trying to stay in the now and to have positive thinking. So even though these might not be as popular as some other methods like sugar and television, they're nevertheless ways to modify experience. If we're trying to stay in the now or always have positive thoughts, then that's an attempt to modify our experience, and it may work or not. But mostly what it does is neutralize. So whether it's sugar or TV or staying in the now, it neutralizes experience to a degree. And then maybe we'll feel comfortable, or maybe we won't. But one thing we can be guaranteed of is that it at some point will not work. There will be something we come up against, and the strategy will not work. The positive thinking, staying in the now, will not work. Another way to modify experience that I've heard a lot about recently is just don't move, stop, and don't move from there. Well, this is just another extreme to adopt. It's another way to try to modify or neutralize what's going on. However, if this is seen as some kind of subtle or overt strategy, there will come a time when one is not able to stop and one is not able to stay in a position where they're not moving, because these are just other points of view. There are other extreme measures, and there's no state that needs to be gotten into. There's no state whatsoever that needs to be gotten into. The movement to do something is just the movement to do something. There can be either a movement to do something or a movement to do nothing. There can be the movement of existence or the movement of non-existence. There can be the movement of this or the movement of that, the movement of is or the movement of isn't. But whatever it is, it all has its ground in awareness, being aware of it. And so to just rest as that awareness while there's movement or no movement is the key. And in awareness, we become more and more confident in the possibility that that awareness is timeless. In other words, not only is awareness timeless in the way that it's not really tied to any notion of a past, it's timeless in that it's not tied to any notion of a future, and it's also timeless in that it's not tied to any notion of now. In timelessness, the true timelessness that saturates all ideas of past, present, and future, there's no reason to take up an extreme anywhere to try to make experience into anything in particular or modify it in any way. And so, you know, many of these things are talked about a lot in some circles. However, very seldom do we see a way of refining our own perception or cognition so that we really have the benefits of what's being talked about. Now, in your own experience, when you come to a conclusion about that experience, a definitive conclusion, then it doesn't matter what anyone else says about your experience. You're just clear on what your experience is, and they can have all kinds of ideas about the nature of everyone's experience or their own, but it's just what it is. It isn't really anything you need to reject or accept. It just is what it is. And so that releases the pressure of phenomena to just allow yourself to be at ease for short moments, repeated many times, introduces you to something about yourself that you haven't noticed, something about you that is completely at ease. And then it's up to you. You can decide whether that's beneficial to you or not. You see, then you have a complete sense of what your experience is. Everything you've heard about your experience and your actual own experience. And then you can decide what is useful to you and what isn't.